Welcome to episode 408 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a very environmentally conscious conversation with environmental law attorney, professor, and director of the Wildlife Law Program for Friends of Animals out of Denver, Colorado, our regular contributor, Michael R. Harris. We discuss how the Biden administration is doing with regard to the environment, some different ways of looking at conservationism, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service working with the NRA, rewilding, and the human connection to all things on Earth, among other things. A very interesting conversation with our good friend Michael R. Harris this week. We also have an EWSA titled Seekers, and we share an excerpt from the groundbreaking book by Peter Singer titled Animal Liberation, and a poem called Thursday Night. All of this, of course, will be imbued, infused with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 408 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Seekers. As another Valentine's Day comes and goes, I think of John and Zeev and LeVar, some of my homes. We have all talked together during this time, reveling with an existence sublime, with touches of consternation, discontent, relentless limitless worry, profound sadness, the lightness of ephemeral yet deep joy. Since I was an immigrant boy, looking at this land, this place, as a space to trace my race without personal distaste, despite some false facts and turned backs, as spun for and from the masses of norm. Those people I talk with and with whom together we fight and do our best to navigate the history of perpetual injustice and conquest and wrong-headed might. Those individuals I've hated and I've loved. I realize when one of them passes on to a great beyond, how important our time together was. It's sincere humanity, as inside me some sort of energy was transferred, concurred, fulfilled, left to learn on its own, yet more wise, through the dance of struggle, seeking to find a genuine compromise that our contemporaries and descendants alike, our friends, compatriots, foes, will understand, if not as directly from us, then somehow filtered to them through the collective. Our work together might resonate, that we are all connected, brothers and sisters, and that only objective faith in what is just, vital of integrity, heart, soul, will fuel love to reign and conquer hate. Thank you for teaching me how to better be consciously on this day into eternity.
Turning the pages in this old book seems familiar. Might be worth a second look. Wrapping up dope in a paper bag, talking to yourself, taking a drag. Business, get what you write. No one's sorry, you did it yourself. It's time to relax now and then give it hell. Someday you'll find what you're looking for. everything you're looking for. Someday you'll find everything you're looking for.
Low EW.
Hello, Michael Harris. Is that you?
Yeah, you found me.
It's nice to have you on Troubadours and Rock on Tours yet again.
Oh, it's great to be here, be back.
Michael Harris is an environmental law attorney. He's a professor and the director of the Wildlife Law Program for Friends of Animals. He is based in, it's Denver, Colorado, right?
Yes, you got it.
Denver. And an old friend of mine, we go way back into the 1990s.
Oh, my.
But you look a lot younger than me. You're doing well, I think.
I just use the same picture over and over again.
Well, you know, last time we spoke was before the 2020 elections, and we were wondering what was going to happen. The last few years, we've been talking on the program about what was indeed occurring, specifically with regard to the natural environment via the administration of number 45 and some of his appointees and very significant federal agencies, as well as Republican party, the support of a lot of his initiatives. Now maybe it's a new day. What do you think so far, what you're seeing with the Biden administration?
Well, you know, I mean, there was a lot of good stuff right off the bat. I mean, we had the, you know, getting us back into the climate accords and signing executive orders that reinstated a lot of the major, you know, environmental policies from the Obama era. That's good stuff. And we have high hopes that, you know, it'll trickle down so that, you know, the policies that are being implemented that aren't, you know, happening right at the White House start to look different, too. We do know, like, the Department of Justice has asked us to take a pause in all of our cases for 60 days because they want the new folks that are going to be at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and at the Bureau of Land Management to be given a chance to sort of get up to date on the litigation and see which way they want to move. So we're hoping that we actually will be settling some of our cases in a favorable way, because the new administration is going to want to, you know, take that stuff back. So far, so good. Good signs, I think.
And when you say yes, you're talking specifically about Friends of Animals, the organization you you represent and work for?
Yeah, I assume they've asked this across the board with other litigation. But yeah, in our cases, they've done that. For instance, we talked about in our last conversation about this ludicrous rule, let me turn this off, by the Trump administration that requires hunting imagery on the duck stamps. These are stamps sold for the conservation of wildlife. So we had that suit filed before the election occurred. And we just got asked to take a pause on that so the new people at Fish and Wildlife Service can see if they want to reconsider that.
Excellent. Excellent. And I know you wanted to talk about the Fish and Wildlife Service today a bit, too, and the NRA. And this was sort of a last-minute thing, wasn't it?
Oh, my gosh. We're talking, exactly 1 week before the inauguration.
Yeah, I saw the date on the document, the MOA, Memorandum of Understanding. It was, I think, January 13, 2021.
Yeah, and it purports to give the NRA a partnership with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to promote the NRA's gun education and early hunting programs for 10 years. And some of us read it to be even longer because it could only really only be dissolved by sort of the consent of both parties. So even after 10 years, the NRA might just say we want to do another round or something. And it's not only a week before the inauguration. This is the day the NRA filed for bankruptcy as well. So you got an organization that I think, you know, people are widely aware of. I mean, it's not like they're, you know, not well known, and they've been around forever. Obviously, they have a stain on their reputation for the way they react with all of the terrible school shootings and mass shootings and their failure to take a stand on that. But the reality is that they've been bleeding money, and internally they have it's filled with fraud. And I think you might have seen in news reports that some of the leadership, including the president, has been siphoning funds. And, you know, it's just a terrible organization, and it all comes tumbling down. You got the state of New York looking to dissolve them legally for fraud and deceit. So they're relocating their headquarters to Dallas, and they file for bankruptcy. And it gets announced the same day. They got this boondoggle of a new relationship with the federal government and a conservation agency, one that's supposed to, you know, be taking care of and be a steward for our wildlife. Giving a set of keys to one of the, you know, worst conservation record organizations you can imagine.
Well, I think some folks, and they, you know, themselves, the NRA would probably argue that what we do is conservation. You know, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, their aim is conservation, so is ours. And, you know, if you have too many deer, for example, they'll suffer. So, you know, we want them not to suffer, so we'll send hunters out during seasons with permits and licenses, and they'll kill a certain amount, and then the deer will not suffer because there won't be too many of them, and so on. What do you think of it? I mean, is that viable?
I think there's a group of people that some of them probably are NRA members that you know, promote that type of belief that you just mentioned. I think it's something that stems from early last century and Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders sort of conservation ethic that, you know, there's a lot of resources out there and, you know, there's enough to go around for the hunters too, and we can manage deer populations. But I think that's a myth now. I think it's a dying myth that is true. I mean, first of all, living with that that philosophy has decimated our not only our animals but our public lands over the last century. We don't have any wolves. Grizzly bears are barely hanging on. Regular bears are barely hanging on. The deer population is completely mismanaged. We have things like chronic wasting disease becoming a huge factor among elk herds and deer herds throughout the country. You know, it's just a total disaster because we've cling to that belief. And the reality is a large number of the people that purport to be engaged in that are doing this for sport and because they get a thrill from it. Or it's, you know, something that they're clinging on to because it's, you know, for them a recreational activity that they grew up doing. And the reality is, and this is a big part of why this MOU was understood and signed, is it's dying. And the number of hunters is just dwindling. We've talked about this before. It's less than probably around 3-5% of the whole U.S. population would check a box that they consider themselves to be a hunter. And that's gone down from being in the high 20s, low 30s, you know, back when you and I first met. So
right.
It's been a very quick downfall for these guys, and they're clinging to these programs to somehow get guns into the hands of children again, younger and younger, so that they could repopulate the hunting group. And more importantly for the NRA, they don't care if they're hunters or they just shoot guns at things, frankly. A larger portion of their membership are just gun enthusiasts and gun radicals, as opposed to hunters that would consider themselves to be a conservationist. And, you know, we did our due diligence. We went on their website and we looked all over. We couldn't find anything supporting their beliefs in conservation, just Second Amendment rights. So
they're not even they've not walked the walk with regard to conservation.
No, they have like these sort of sister or maybe you just call them, you know, affiliated groups, like a place. I think one of them is called Conservation Force. It's really just one guy who sort of runs their conservation, quote unquote, values, and the NRA pumps some money into that program and that organization from time to time. But as an organization itself, it's not something I think they've taken a big platform on until they get an opportunity to sign up with Trump and the Trump kids, probably to help their fledgling organization survive through the public. Some public funding and public assistance.
Yeah, it's a grifter's scam, it sounds like, which falls right in line with the Trump family. This when I'm looking at the MOU, it mentions some organization called the Partners for Fish and the Partners for Fish and Wildlife. That's they want the USFWS, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, and the NRA. The National Rifle Association, to partner with this, to be in this group, Partners for Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah, so the Partners for Fish and Wildlife is actually established decades ago under, I believe it's the Federal Aid and Wildlife Restoration Act. And it's a partnership between the federal government and states, and it is developed based upon this, again, dying philosophy that hunting and conservation have, you know, some type of bond between them, and the states in particular rely heavily on using hunting licensing fees to support their conservation programs, way too heavily, in fact, because, again, the problem is that money's drying up and they don't have alternative sources. As a result, conservation programs are underfunded in the states. But so it was designed originally for the federal governments and states to work together using money like from the duck stamps or from other conservation programs that the federal government runs. There was a tax on ammunition that was used to fund it, but it was designed to provide support to the state programs. Again, they're misguided in my mind as well, but you can understand how that relationship would have developed, you know, in the 1960s, 1970s, when hunting was really touted as a big part of the state conservation programs. But that doesn't give them authority to bring in the NRA to, you know, benefit from that program as it still exists.
Right. And I guess it's clear that the appointee to run the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service from Trump was of the mindset that would fall in line with all of this antiquated thinking, whereas now, as you mentioned earlier, everyone's asked by the Justice Department to hold off on their concerns and their lawsuits because we have new appointees coming in.
Our big hope is the Biden administration will say, you know, settle this lawsuit. I mean, this thing we hope won't even you know, get out of the gate very far.
Are you chiming in on this one, on this MOU, your organization?
Oh, we filed a lawsuit over this. Yeah, we did just a week and a half ago. We challenged it that there's no law that would allow Fish and Wildlife Service to put their signature on this agreement. They have, you might have seen, they have a section in it called authorities.
Yep, I did.
And they just list every possible law they could think of. But we have looked through every one of those, and they're just completely unrelated to what this MOU is about.
The Fish and Wildlife Act of 1956, the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, 16 USC, and so on. National Wildlife Refuge System Administration Act. These are the authorities that they're saying they have. This is what legitimizes the scheme that they've come up with.
Yeah, and the first two have to do with promoting fisheries and some public coordination for fisheries. The Refuge System Act is exactly what it is, to establish and to administer wildlife refuges around the country.
And you're fine with that.
Oh, yeah, but then none of them say you could, you know, enter into partnerships. And I guess for your listeners who aren't lawyers, a bedrock principle of basically administrative law, because Fish and Wildlife Service is an agency, an administrative agency, is they have no, like, inherent power to do anything. Congress has to explicitly provide them authority to do something. And so we look through these statutes saying, okay, where can you plausibly see Congress saying, hey, enter into MOUs with private entities? And this would go even if, like, they entered into a MOU with Friends of Animals, you right. know? There's just no authority to do that. Again, the closest one, in a way, is the Federal Aid and Wildlife Restoration Act, because it has the authority for them to enter into relationships with the states to promote hunting. But that's it. It says states. It doesn't say, you know, anyone else. It doesn't say
the federal government.
Yeah. So it really takes this off the board. And then the last one is a secretarial order. That's basically an attempt by the Secretary of Interior to give itself authority to do that. And that it has to come from Congress. And so this is just, in our mind, should be a slam dunk case. We got a good judge in D.C., he's a senior judge and a former Clinton appointee. So not a Bush, not a Trump appointee. So that was good. But our real hopes here is that, you know, we will just, you know, get an opportunity to sit down with the Department of Justice and Fish and Wildlife Service. And they're going to want to hopefully back out of this thing.
All the new folks in charge.
Yeah. Why do they want a relationship with it? NRA. This is too close.
Right, right. It makes total sense. Yeah, I don't know. And the NRA is not even that big. It's big in power, but I think there are 5 million members.
That's true. I've had these conversations with folks in the past. They're not that big. They're just well known, and they have, you know, like Charles and Heston ran it for a while as a figurehead, and you know, they're just well known. But what they do well, of course, is they use all their money for one thing, right? To pay off basically Republican members of Congress not to do anything. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's why they're effective. You know, they're not doing really anything else. That's it. And making bumper stickers.
Right. They get into the psychology of a lot of voters saying you're going to lose your Second Amendment right if you don't support us. And that's such a valuable thing to be able to bear arms, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's a scam. It is. Oh boy, it's always a pleasure talking to you, Michael Harris. I don't want to keep you too much on this one. Good luck with the lawsuit. Maybe you won't even have to go there on this particular MOU.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
And I know you also are excited to talk with us a bit about the lawsuit that you're a part of in Colorado regarding the hunting licenses that were made necessary, I guess, to go and access state lands there in Colorado. How'd things go there?
Yeah. So same philosophy here, right? Colorado, like many other states, we rely heavily on funding from hunting and fishing licenses to support, you know, state parks and state conservation efforts. And it's a model that the states are sort of clinging to. And eventually, in my mind, it's going to fail. The money's just going to not be there. And we're going to have to look for other sources. Unfortunately, in Colorado, and some of your listeners might recall from our discussion last year, they decided to try to just expand the pie by making more people buy hunting and fishing licenses. So for certain public trust lands, they told people who were out there to, you know, birders or hikers or, you know, artists, whoever was out there recreating on these lands and were not carrying guns or fishing rods, that in order to continue to use them, they had to purchase a hunting or fishing license. And that, of course, sounds absurd to us, and only, I think, gives the state an opportunity to say, hey, look at all the revenue that we raised last year from hunting and fishing, when really we don't know how many of those people were just there because to do other things, recreate, but were forced to buy them. So we sued the state of Colorado over it. We survived a motion to dismiss our claims just 2 weeks ago. But we have heard and actually seen now that the Colorado Wildlife Commission is going to rescind that rule. And they're putting in place instead the ability to buy a day recreation pass or an annual recreation pass. You know, there's still a lot of folks who feel like it's unfair to have to pay to use public lands. And I get that. I used to be one. I was in California when they started to make us pay to use U.S. forest lands in Southern California. And I thought, what? You know, I pay my taxes. You know, they're out there spending it on military items, and I have to pay to, you know, get out of my car and take a hike. But it's a reality, and I think as I've gotten older, I mean, it's a privilege to be able to use these lands, and if that's what it's going to take for now, I would prefer to see taxes on recreational goods, you know, so that it sort of comes in through the purchase of a nice Patagonia jacket or something. But, you know, it is sort of heading this way right now where we're going to have passes to use public lands. And we already do for national parks and national monuments for the most part anyway. So for us, this is good because it's, you know, for one thing, it'll make a clear line. We'll be able to see where the revenue is really coming from. And our hope is that we're going to be able to show over the next 5 to 10 years that it's not the hunters and the fishers who are paying for these great lands and for the animals that are on them and their conservation.
That's a great point. And you know, the thing, I mean, the larger picture here, we're talking about specific scenarios and trends, and they lead to ethical questions and pragmatic analysis of what, how we could indeed sustain the funding needs of our natural environment and our national treasures. The thing that I wonder is, how do you see it as an advocate for other animals and the natural environment, generally speaking, the mindset that seems to be developing, from my view at least, of most people, in terms of their sense of connection to other animals and the natural environment? It seems to me that connection is waning. People are less connected. Do you see that as an issue or no?
I think that, you know, it just sort of depends on where you live. I mean, I think that remains very true in the big urban centers. But I don't feel that way necessarily with respect to the population generally. I mean, there's actually, in my mind, if we could popularize, that is, make the process for protecting animals and for conserving open space and public lands, if we can make it more democratic. See, this is the problem, is that because these agencies are funded by hunters, they coddle them. And so we have these anti-animal policies like, you know, no wolves, no bears, keep the herds, you know, in places that are accessible and all this kind of stuff. And when we can get rid of that, and that's why we're focusing on this work, like destroying the MOU or attacking this facade of buy and hunting license or rec users, I think that we could start to see a more open and democratic process that caters to what people who live in Colorado or live in Wyoming or visit here really want to see. And they really want to see, you know, nature that is nature, not manipulated. So one thing that came up since we last talked as well, and this is really cool, Colorado voters approved reintroduction of wolves into the state. And so that's sort of what I believe. I think that's what people want. People want to know that nature exists and that they could visit it. And it's these agencies and their hunting lobbyists, and to some extent ag as well, that has prohibited these policies from reflecting what I think most people do want. And we also, with our new governor, he actually finally appointed someone to the Wildlife Commission here in Colorado who actually gives a darn about animals. My actually former predecessor at the University of Denver Environmental Law Clinic, where I used to work, Jay Touchton, was appointed by our governor to be on that commission, which has usually been represented by like people in the ag industry or people in the hunting industry who have a real like crabbed, narrow view about what wildlife conservation should look like. But I think if people had a chance to participate, they're interested in a lot more dynamic natural world than we currently have.
And when you say dynamic, we only have a couple minutes left. Can you expound?
Yeah, I think they want to see predators in the environment. I think they want to see habitats rewild, right, is a term we often use, you know. It's beautiful outdoors, but it's not very dynamic. There's not a lot of diversity of species in most public lands and open space and state lands. They're limited to the deer and to the elk and to a few others. And I think people want to see what it was like before all these predators and all these other animals went away. I think we're starting to like need that even more.
Yeah, I you know, we are animals too, and I think that's our nature. And you know, when you say we need it even more, I think it is an instinctive sort of you know, an intrinsic. It's in our bones, or if you believe soul, in our soul to have that kind of connection to the natural environment. So maybe,
Our DNA has traces of every living thing that ever walked on the earth before us, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're sort of, when it comes to where we're at in the earth's sort of development of life, you know, we're at the far end of it from when it started right now. So everything that walked the planet is in our DNA, and that sort of gives us, I think, what you just said, EW, this sort of built-in sense of where we are and what we belong to.
Well said. Attorney Michael R. Harris here on Troubadours and Rock on Tours, a regular contributor, I'm proud to say, a good friend of mine. He's a professor as well, and you can tell by the very clear, dynamic way you explain these complicated
issues. You make it very accessible, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I hope that's reflected on my end-of-year evaluations once.
Yeah. Yeah, you mean from us? Yeah. You're going to get all 10s and we're going to increase your pay by 20%.
That's perfect.
20% of nothing.
It is nothing.
But nonetheless, we cherish the time we have you on the program, and I look forward to our next conversation. Good luck with all the work you're doing, and of course, keep us posted.
Thank you, EW. You have a good one.
Take care.
This brand new gift, looking for somebody to share it with. I found this brand new light, something within me all of my life. There's so much trouble in the world, surrounded by miracles. There's so much hatred undeserved, but it will not work, 'cause still our love will be received. Better yet still, my heart is in need of release. Yet still, my love will be received. Better yet still, my heart is in need of release. But it ain't about justice.
So much hatred undeserved, but it will not work, 'cause still our love will be received. Better yet still, my heart is in need of release. Oh yeah, still my love will be received.
And now, an excerpt from Peter Singer's groundbreaking book, Animal Liberation. This excerpt is titled, Morally Indefensible. We have always liked to think ourselves less savage than the other animals. To say that a person is, quote, humane is to say that he is kind. To say that he is, quote, a beast, quote, brutal, or simply that he behaves, quote, like an animal, is to suggest that he is cruel and nasty. We rarely stop to consider that the animal that kills with the least reason to do so is the human animal. We think of lions and wolves as savage because they kill, but they must kill or starve. Humans kill other animals for sport, to satisfy their curiosity, to beautify their bodies, and to please their palates. Humans also kill members of their own species for greed or power. Moreover, humans are not content with mere killing. Throughout history, they have shown a tendency to torment and torture both their fellow humans and their fellow animals before putting them to death. No other animal shows much interest in doing so. While we overlook our savagery,
we exaggerate that of other animals. The notorious wolf, for instance, villain of so many folk tales, has been shown by a careful investigation of zoologists in the wild to be a highly social animal, a faithful and affectionate spouse, not just for a season, but for life, a devoted parent, and a loyal member of the pack. Wolves almost never kill anything except to eat it. If males should fight among themselves, the fight ends with a gesture of submission in which the loser offers to his conqueror the underside of his neck, the most vulnerable part of his body. With his fangs only an inch away from the jugular vein of his foe, the victor will be content with submission and, unlike a human conqueror, does not kill the vanquished opponent. In keeping with our picture of the world of animals as a bloody scene of combat, we ignore the extent to which other species exhibit a complex social life, recognizing and relating to other members of their species as individuals. When human beings marry, we attribute their closeness to each other to love, and we feel keenly for a human being who has lost his or her spouse. When other animals pair for life, we say that it is just instinct that makes them do so. And if a hunter or trapper kills an animal or captures it for research or for a zoo, we do not consider that it might have a spouse who will suffer from its sudden absence. In a similar way, we know that to part a human mother from her child is tragic for both. But neither the farmer nor the breeder of pets and research animals gives any thought to the feelings of the non-human mothers and children whom he routinely separates as part of his business. Curiously, while people often dismiss complex aspects of animal behavior as, quote, mere instinct, and therefore not worthy of comparison with the apparently similar behavior of human beings, these same people will also ignore or overlook the importance of simple instinctive patterns of behavior when it is convenient for them to do so. Thus, it is often said of laying hens, veal calves, and dogs kept in cages for experimental purposes that this does not cause them to suffer since they have never known other conditions. This is a fallacy. Animals feel a need to exercise, stretch their limbs or wings, groom themselves, and turn around, whether or not they have ever lived in conditions that permit this. Herd or flock animals are disturbed when they are isolated from others of their species, though they may never have known other conditions. And too large a herd or flock can have the same effect through the inability of the individual animal to recognize other individuals. These stresses reveal themselves in, quote, vices like cannibalism. Widespread ignorance of the nature of non-human animals allows those who treat animals in this manner to brush off criticism by saying that, after all, quote, they're not human. Indeed, they are not. But neither are they machines for converting fodder into flesh, nor tools for research. Considering how far the knowledge of the public lags behind the most recent findings of zoologists and ethologists who have spent months and sometimes years observing animals with notebook and camera, the dangers of sentimental anthropomorphism are less serious than the opposite danger of the convenient and self-serving idea that animals are lumps of clay which we can mold in whatever manner we please. Animals themselves are incapable of demanding their own liberation, or of protecting against their condition with votes, demonstrations, or boycotts. Human beings have the power to continue to oppress other species forever, or until we make this planet unsuitable for living beings. Will our tyranny continue, proving that morality counts for nothing when it clashes with self-interest, as the most cynical of poets and philosophers have always said? Or will we rise to the challenge and prove our capacity for genuine altruism by ending our ruthless exploitation of the species in our power? Not because we are forced to do so by rebels or terrorists, but because we recognize that our position is morally indefensible. I'm a
Thursday night. Doritos, fruit snacks, mismatched cups, but cereal bowls, and a half a pint of beer. Look up, and outside the kitchen window, I see there near the swing set are three black and white-tailed deer. So queer do I feel today, teeming with heavy, twisted, misanthropic cheer. And there you have it, episode 408 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Michael R. Harris. Also, I'd like to thank Peter Singer and these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Leanne La Havas, Neil Young and Crazy Horse, Citizen Cope, The Rolling Stones, J.J. Cale, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard too. And of course, I would like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.